Will he stay or will he go? President Joe Biden vows to stay in the race against Donald Trump, despite growing calls for him to bow out.
I think I'm the most qualified person to run for president. I beat him once, and I will beat him again.
And next week's Republican National Convention puts the spotlight back on Donald Trump.
We typically see a candidate getting a boost out of the convention.
And NATO wraps up its summit in Washington with unity over support for Ukraine and concern over the alliance's future ahead of the U.S. presidential election.
The allies really recognize that they need to be ready and able to defend themselves.
Today is Saturday, July 13th. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington. President Joe Biden left Washington for Michigan on Friday as he and his team continue their relentless sprint to persuade lawmakers, donors, and voters that he is still up for the job.
The best way to assure them is the way I assure myself, and that is, am I getting the job done? Am I getting the job done?
It followed his highly anticipated news conference Thursday night with a forceful defense of his ability to serve another 4 years.
I believe I'm the best qualified to govern. And I think I'm the best qualified to win.
But even after he gave detailed answers about his foreign and domestic policies, Biden flubbed a response to whether Vice President Kamala Harris is qualified to do the job, accidentally referencing Donald Trump in one of his first answers.
I wouldn't have picked Vice President Trump to be vice president, but I think she was not qualified to be president. So let's start there.
While many lawmakers have expressed unease with Biden's continued candidacy, others, like Representative James Clyburn, have steadfastly maintained their support for the president.
The conversation should focus on the record of this administration, on the alternative to his election, and let Joe Biden continue to make his own decisions about his future.
As of Friday, over a dozen members of Congress have called for Biden to bow out of the campaign and end his reelection bid against Donald Trump. The turmoil continues as Republicans hold their convention next week, where Trump will officially become their party's nominee. Joining us now for analysis on whether Biden's news conference helped him move past doubts over his ability to win is Jessica Taylor, political analyst and editor with the Cook Political Report.
The press conference, I think he did enough to stop a deluge, but right after the fact that you had the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Jim Himes, come out with a statement, you've had another frontline Democrat, Mark Levin in California, come out. There is this drip drip that is still happening. Did the dam break? No. And I think that just leaves us in sort of a state of suspended animation right now, where I think we're still unclear what the path is going forward. I was really struck by the fact that there did seem to be a tone change from the interview that the president did with George Stephanopoulos to his remarks at the press conference. You know, he said initially, you know, only if God Almighty came down would I change my mind and not run. And he seemed to at least leave the door ajar, saying that, you know, if his team showed him numbers where he could not win, and, you know, he's very complimentary of his vice president, Kamala Harris. We've seen reports out that the campaign is polling how she would run in these swing states and against Donald Trump. So I saw a little bit of an opening there, but really still this feels like an hour by hour story where it does feel like if there is some big shift, it all just still feels like we're very much in limbo.
Would dropping out hurt or help Democratic chances in November? Because they're worried about the polls, but it looks like today, as far as I can tell, it's a statistical tie.
It is a statistical tie, I think, when you look at some of the national numbers. But when you look at the state-by-state numbers, which is really key here, because of the just built-in advantage that Republicans have in the Electoral College, you know, Biden won the last election by 4 points nationally in the popular vote, and he still just had a very narrow Electoral College win by only a few thousand votes in key states. But we're seeing states that he won in 2020 move pretty pronouncedly in President Trump's direction. Here at the Cook Political Report this week, we moved three states, Nevada, Arizona, and Georgia, from our toss-up column into the lean Republican column. And what this really leaves is that there's one path that we see for Biden being able to get to 270 electoral votes, and that is by keeping that blue wall intact, by winning Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Just electorally, Donald Trump has many more paths, where if he wins the states that we have in our lean Republican column and picks off only one of those three Midwest states, then he would surpass 270.
The division is so strong, though. The people that are supporting him are digging in, saying, you know, he has proven that he is completely competent, and he proved that, you know, discussing foreign policy in his news conference. On the other hand, the numbers of people that are saying he needs to drop out continue to rise. And I think that doing this in publicly would seem like it actually turned it into something bigger than the bad debate.
I think that there were more opportunities for Biden to shore up some of his support in going out more in more unscripted events in the immediate days after, and reaching out more to congressional leaders and rank and file Democrats, particularly ones that were in that are in very tough races. You'd asked too earlier about whether this could work for Democrats. We don't know. Like, is this an untenable position for President Biden? And I think if the election were held today, he would lose. The election is not held today, though, and we've seen certainly a lot of twists and turns in the past few presidential elections. Donald Trump was seen as dead in the water after the Access Hollywood tape just a few weeks before the election in 2016. So there's never an absolute in politics that this person is absolutely going to lose. Just what the numbers tell us today, and we don't have another historical precedent for a nominee, an incumbent president, being replaced this late in the game when Lyndon Johnson decided not to run. The primary process was still going on. It was much earlier in the year. You know, we don't know if that would, it certainly seems like it would be handed off. There could be a more smooth transition of power handing this off to Vice President Harris instead of some type of floor fight in Chicago. Could that re-energize Democrats? Could it change things? We just don't have enough data right now.
So there's not even enough data to know whether Vice President Harris picking up the reins could turn the polls around?
We have seen some data where she is running a little bit better, and I think another option might excite the Democratic base. But I think that where we are, I would look for the polling in the next couple of weeks. Also, I think anything taken during the Republican National Convention next week might skew a little bit more toward Republicans. We typically see a candidate getting a boost out of the convention. You know, last week was, immediate week after the debate, was a holiday. It's a bad time to poll. So unfortunately, we're sort of in a polling black hole here that I think anything until we might not have, I think, the best reflective numbers for a couple of weeks just because of outside confluences.
Do you think that the Republican convention next week might take away some of the bad publicity for Biden, or will it put more pressure on him?
It would turn the focus more toward Trump, and that could be a good thing or that could be a bad thing, depending upon, you know, if he remains disciplined, who his vice presidential nominee is. That's one thing, is that Trump managed to stay quiet and out of the news with all of this and sort of let Biden have the bad news cycle, which is not something that we're accustomed to see him doing. So how long is he able to sort of maintain that discipline as well? And what is the message coming out of the convention? We just don't know yet.
Jessica Taylor, political analyst with the Cook Political Report, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. NATO leaders headed home Friday after the three-day summit in Washington, in which they celebrated the alliance's 75th anniversary and made long-term commitments of military support for Ukraine, promising that its future is in NATO.
All allies agree that Ukraine will become a member, but it's too early to say exactly when that will happen.
Over 3 days in Washington, Ukraine, Russia, and the threat posed by an increasingly aggressive China dominated formal discussions, while also under a cloud of political uncertainty for its most powerful member, the United States.
For 75 years, our nations have grown and prospered behind the NATO shield. Today, We're stronger than we've ever been.
Leaders were united in stating their confidence in President Biden's leadership. Finnish President Alexander Stubb.
I have absolutely no concerns about the capacity of the current president of the United States to lead his country and to lead our fight for Ukraine and to lead NATO. And I think this summit speaks tons and volumes for that.
Joining us now for a deeper look into the gathering is Rose Gottemuller, lecturer at Stanford University and research fellow at the Hoover Institute. She was also the Deputy Secretary General of NATO from 2016 to 2019. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. Beyond the overall political crisis brewing in the United States that overshadowed the summit, what's your overall take on how the summit went?
First of all, I was surprised at the overall coherence, and it sounds bad to say a well-choreographed summit, but it was. It was coherent, it was well-planned, and it was a good show. And, you know, funny that the issue to do with the president, with President Biden, made the show more visible to the U.S. public, which, to be honest, I welcome. Because I think that that means that NATO now means something in most living rooms across America, at least those who pay attention to the news at all. And for me, that's a good thing.
It certainly seemed like it was a serious summit. In all accounts, would you say it was a successful summit when it comes to the goals that they wanted to achieve?
I think it was a successful summit from the point of view that they were keen to ensure the continued reliability and resilience of assistance to Ukraine of all kinds. Assistance related to military equipment, but also related to the training of Ukrainian forces. And finally, and most importantly, that Ukraine is now on an irreversible bridge to membership. That was the term of art adopted. But it was important, I think, from the perspective that those three goals surrounding Ukraine have now been placed on, I would say, a very reliable track going forward. And that will, I think, abide no matter what political ups and downs occur, either in the United States or in Europe, to be honest.
Do you think that President Biden met the moment as far as being the host and keeping it on track and gave his counterparts confidence?
Well, I can only recount what I've seen in the media, and I'll start with an interview I heard with Chancellor Scholz of Germany on public television, and he was very clear and unequivocal in saying that he had been with the president not only through the summit, but on multiple occasions since assuming the chancellorship, and remarked on his leadership and on his command of the issues and of his understanding of the strategic stakes for NATO's role in Europe. And I believe that that kind of presentation or those kinds of points are probably what multiple leaders are saying to press in their own country and to international press who asked them. So it seemed that the leaders were indeed quite gathered behind Biden and really appreciating the role he was playing in leading not only the summit meeting, but the NATO alliance as a whole. The second thing I wanted to say is I watched the president's press conference. It was the end of the NATO summit. Once again, I was excited because usually NATO summit meeting press conferences don't get this kind of attention, but there was a lot of excitement coming, of course, from the U.S. press corps wanting to hammer President Biden with questions about his health. But I thought he handled it with aplomb, and it was particularly interesting to me that he delivered some stiff messages to President Xi Jinping of China and President Vladimir Putin of Russia. And then also, I thought Perry the marks and questions about his health in a humorous way, particularly at the end as he was striding off the stage.
Certainly there is international anxiety across Europe and Asia and other places over what will happen with the election and what that means for the world and for the alliance. Potential Trump presidency is raising concern among Europeans, particularly. He's repeatedly questioned NATO's relevance, suggesting he might withdraw. We've heard the comments that the alliance is working to Trump-proof the NATO alliance. What does Trump-proofing the alliance mean?
Yes, I've heard that term as well, and I'm reflecting back on my time as Deputy Secretary General in 2016 to 2019 when Trump was in his first term as president. And to be honest with you, based on that experience, the best way to work with Mr. Trump is to really continue keeping attention on defense expenditures and the necessity of the NATO allies beyond the United States really picking up responsibility for defense expenditures, the famous pledge to commit 2% of GDP to defense that came out of the NATO summit in Wales in 2014 when Russia first invaded Ukraine and seized Crimea. So this has been on the books now for 10 years, but while I was DSG and when Trump was first coming to the alliance headquarters in Brussels, he was furious because fewer than 10 of the NATO allies at that point had reached 2% of GDP. And now he's going to find a much different alliance should he be elected, because now the allies really recognize that they need to be ready and able to defend themselves. And so now at the time of the summit meeting in Washington, 23 out of 32 NATO allies are at 2% of GDP. And that's very good. And the trend is in the right direction. And the second thing is that they are considering 2%, not a ceiling, but a floor. And many are saying we are going beyond 2% of GDP. So this is very, very healthy. Well, it does have to do with Trump. He started the momentum going, but it more seriously has to do with Vladimir Putin and the threat of his aggression to Ukraine, but there are grave concerns about broader aggression against Europe. And so that has really spurred the allies to step up to this responsibility. And so Trump's going to find a much different NATO. And I think it's a NATO that he can take some satisfaction in starting the ball rolling.
Vladimir Putin himself has been emboldening himself with alliances, including North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and of course, Viktor Orban of Hungary, who was just at Mar-a-Lago meeting with Donald Trump. Does that strike a concern beyond the monetary issues that Trump is just more aligned with these dictators? And if he were to be reelected, would this embolden him to take a completely different stance from the United States about what Russia is doing?
Well, it's difficult to predict Donald Trump. If there's anything you can say about him, he's unpredictable. But I wanted to parse your question a bit, because Vladimir Putin, he doesn't have allies like the United States of America has allies. He maybe has Belarus in that camp, but these other countries are not the same. They are partners of convenience in many cases. They are partners in trade and for economic reasons. And that, I think, is clear and evident in the cooperation between China and Russia and between India and Russia. They're getting their oil supplies and gas supplies from Russia. In the case of Hungary, he's still getting some of his gas supplies from Russia, as well as Russia's building their nuclear power plant. So they are different. I would call them alliances in the same way NATO is an alliance. They are partnerships of convenience in many cases. And yes, Putin is benefiting from them in terms of getting key components or some of his high-tech weapon systems. The NATO allies really delivered a message to China that they are enabling Putin's war machine. And I thought that was a tough message and an appropriate message to send to China. So as far as what Mr. Trump will do, we will have to see. People are worried that he says he's going to end this war in Ukraine in 24 hours. But one thing I will say also about Donald Trump, he hates to be known as a loser. And if he is seen as and going down in history as having lost this war in Ukraine because of his accommodation to Vladimir Putin, he's not going to like that. And you could see that in the way he behaved with the DPRK 5 years ago when he simply walked away. He really wanted that deal with Kim Jong-un. He wanted to be the great peacemaker with regard to the nuclear and missile systems in North Korea. But when he couldn't get the deal he wanted, he walked away. So I think he's equally capable of saying, hey, this is going to make me look like a loser. I'm not going to stick with this. Let's keep pushing to get Ukraine to the place they need to be to succeed at the negotiating table. And that is precisely the Biden administration's approach.
I think there are a lot of concerns that when he says he would end the war in 24 hours, that he means just basically letting Russia have what it wants and taking a sovereign country and not stopping there.
Exactly. And that is what history will judge him on and judge him as a loser.
If it were to happen that Donald Trump is reelected president and does decide to pull the U.S. out of NATO, does NATO survive? Can NATO defend itself without the United States? And what would happen?
I know he's threatened time and again to pull the U.S. out of NATO, but I don't think he will for two reasons. One, that, as I said, NATO's a much different NATO nowadays, and it's stepping up to the bar in terms of paying for its own defense. And that satisfies one of Trump's main demands on the alliance. But second, he wants to pivot to Asia. That's very clear. And he wants the NATO allies to be able to defend themselves in Europe. And so why would he pull out when he can, you know, essentially gain his strategic objective of pivoting to Asia and facing off with the Chinese? And so that is, I think, a strategic goal that he would not want to disturb. He's, again, focused on continuing to be seen as the great man and one who is not a loser. And really, if he is reflecting at all on what he wants his second term in office to look like, it's going to be one of having sorted things out in both Europe and Asia. There's a third aspect that I think is important, and that is the political. The U.S. Congress has now passed legislation, last year's National Defense Authorization Act, said that the president, in order to withdraw from NATO, must by law come to the Congress and consult. And, you know, Trump is also a political animal. He is not going to want to burn the political capital it would take to withdraw from NATO, to take on the House and the Senate. He might draw back from NATO, for example, by not appointing an ambassador to NATO and not taking a U.S. leadership role in NATO, in which case there would have to be, I think, some strong action by other NATO member states, and they are thinking about that and how to continue to make sure that the alliance is running and running well. There's a new Secretary General coming in, Mark Rutte from the Netherlands. He's a savvy and experienced leader in Europe, having been the Prime Minister of the Netherlands for 14 years. And there are other very experienced leaders around the NATO table. So I think they'll be able to pull it off should Trump decide to, I call it kind of a soft withdrawal, that he would back out of U.S. leadership, but I don't think he would take the United States out of the alliance. It's just too much of a hassle for him.
But the Article 5 issue, all for one, one for all, he's basically stated that he would tell Russia to do whatever it wants if people don't pay.
Yeah, if countries aren't paying. But now most countries are paying, so that makes a big difference. And I think, furthermore, he will be clearly banking on his buddy Putin not to do anything mischievous to cause him problems. As we look at it, it seems ridiculous. But in terms of how he will think about it as a situation where he won't be put to that Article 5 test, I think, during his time in office.
But if he were to pull out of the U.S. out of NATO, can NATO continue in its capacity to defend itself?
Well, the United States is the premier inter pares at NATO, the first among equals. So it would be extremely tough if the United States were totally to absent itself from Europe. I do note that there is stronger and stronger cooperation between NATO and the European Union now, including on defense and security matters. The European Union, after much hand-wringing and reflection about what we call strategic autonomy, you know, can they develop a European Union military capability that could go it alone without the United States, I think has decided that they need NATO because NATO has the established command structure, NATO has the established training and interoperability, and so NATO and the European Union are working closely together now. So it's perhaps on that basis that the alliance can weather a Trump decision to somehow pull back from the alliance. The big thing for the NATO allies in that case is that the United States does provide a lot of what we call military enablers, like the air-to-air refueling capability or the big military transport planes, and that enabling capacity would have to be generated by NATO allies on their own. And that would be a heavy lift, a very difficult and expensive lift. So there are those kinds of issues to be addressed. But in terms of can NATO survive? Well, my view is yes, it won't be easy and it won't be the same alliance, but yes, it can survive and it can survive in cooperation with the European Union.
Do you think that January 6th changed how the world views the United States?
Well, that's a big question. I think that it really alighted a lot of fears because the United States is also and has, you know, in its history, thought of itself as the kind of shining city on the hill with regard to our democracy. And I think the January 6th events shook that vision of the United States as the central leader in democratic practice across the world and the example to other countries across the world. And so I do think that it alarmed many, many countries and concerned them very much. But I've also heard people from across the globe, not only from the Northern Hemisphere, but also from the Southern Hemisphere, comment, look, your institutions worked, your court system worked. You prosecuted people and put them in jail if they perpetrated violence on January 6th. That would never happen in our country. So even though democracy was under attack on January 6th, your institutions held together. And I think it's up to all of us to ensure that our institutions continue to hold together and perform no matter what happens.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Oh, you are welcome.
Rose Gottemuller, lecturer at Stanford University and research fellow at the Hoover Institute and former Deputy Secretary General of NATO. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition, Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.